The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. My name is Jason Freeman, and I'm pleased to be here to introduce tonight's guest, Dara Horn. Praised by the Washington Post for their signature blend of tragedy and spirituality, Dara Horn's novels include In the Image, The World to Come, and A Guide for the Perplexed. One of Grant's best young American novelists, Horn is the recipient of two National Jewish Book Awards, the Edward Lewis Wallant Award and the Reform Judaism Fiction Prize, among other honors. She's a former teacher of Jewish literature and Israeli history at Harvard University, Sarah Lawrence College, and City University of New York, a contributor to The Atlantic and The New York Times, and the author of the best-selling nonfiction book, ebook, The Rescuer. She is here tonight with her new book, People Love Dead Jews, Reports from a Haunted Present. Based on research, family history, and world travel, it examines the contradictory cultural fascination with Jewish death that exists next to a paradoxical lack of respect for Jewish life. Pulitzer Prize winner Tom Rice writes, Dara Horn has an uncommon mastery of the literary essay, and she applies it here with a relentless, even furious purpose. In a review in the New York Times claims that People Love Dead Jews is an outstanding book with a bold mission. It criticizes people, artworks, and public institutions that few others dare to challenge. Tonight's author will be in conversation with Adam Kirsch, an editor at the Wall Street Journal's Week in Review section and a 2016 Guggenheim Fellow. He is the author of several books of poetry and criticism, including The Thousand Wells, Who Wants to Be a Jewish Writer, and The Blessing and the Curse, The Jewish People and Their Books in the 20th Century. And before we get to a talk, we have a short audio trailer for Dara's podcast, Adventures with Dead Jews. And let's go ahead and give that a listen now.
There are far too many dead Jews out there to fit in one book. I'm also bringing you this companion podcast, Adventures with Dead Jews, with a totally different set of stories that were a bit too weird for the book itself. We're going to cover everything from Jewish Confederate monuments to why some Holocaust movies aren't as good for us as we think. We'll talk about Soviet Yiddish actors, a massive medieval document dump, and a bizarre Japanese attempt to create a Jewish state. We'll explore the outsized role that dead Jews play in other people's imaginations and how Jews who happen to be alive have navigated a weird world that sometimes prefers them dead. I'm Dara Horn, and I hope you'll join me for Adventures with Dead Jews. Subscribe now while we're all still alive to enjoy it.
What a teaser that is. That's such a good, I like every one of those subjects I think I want to learn more about. Thank you both for being here. Dara, Adam, the screen is all yours. Have a good talk.
Great. Well, thanks so much. And Dara, it's a pleasure to be here with you to talk about your new book. I feel like I should show the cover so people will know what they're looking for in the bookstore. And I thought there's a lot to talk about in the book, but I thought we could start by talking about that title, which I think is definitely one of the best titles for a book that I've heard. It just makes you sit up and ask, what is this book going to be about? So tell us about People Love Dead Jews, how you thought of that as a subject and as an idea for a book.
First of all, I just want to say thank you to Free Library Philadelphia for hosting us this evening in the Luminiferous Ether. We're delighted to be here. And Adam, it's great to see you again. Yeah, I still can't believe my publisher let me keep this title. I kind of feel like I got away with something. So this idea sort of came to me a few years ago. So as you heard, I mean, I've written, this is my sixth book. I've written five novels. And about in 2018, I was asked by Smithsonian Magazine to write a piece about Anne Frank. And I just remember getting this request and feeling this overwhelming sense of dread. Because I'm like, wow, I really don't want to write about Anne Frank. And the logical thing would be to turn this assignment down. I'm not a very logical person. I just sort of thought, you know, this is interesting. Why do I not want to do this? And in my work as a writer for, you know, the past 20 years writing these books, I've often noticed that like the place where we feel uncomfortable is where the story is. And I just was thinking about like why do I really not want to write this piece? And I remembered a news item that I had read about earlier that year, so this is 2018, of something that had happened at the Anne Frank Museum in Amsterdam. This was, this is this blockbuster museum where it's the place where it contains these like tiny secret rooms that Anne Frank and other persecuted Jews were living in, both until they were arrested by the Nazis and taken to Auschwitz. Place where she was hiding is now like this, you know, as I said, this blockbuster museum. You know, when it's not COVID, there's like, you know, I don't know, millions of visitors there every year. In this museum, there was in 2018, a young Jewish employee who was wearing his yarmulke to work, and his employers told him that he wasn't allowed to do that, and he had to hide his yarmulke under a baseball hat. So he then appealed to the museum board, and the board deliberated about this for 4 months and then finally relented and let this guy wear his yarmulke to work. And I just remember thinking, reading this news story and thinking, you know, 4 months seems like a very long time for the Anne Frank house to ponder whether or not it was a good idea to force a Jew into hiding. And I just like thinking about this, and I'm like, you know, this wasn't really it might be a public relations mishap, but it wasn't really a mistake. And, you know, and I was just, so I just thought, you know, there's something else going on here. There's like emotional work being done by dead Jews that is entirely divorced and actually in a lot of ways antithetical to respect for living Jews. And so I wrote this piece for Smithsonian. And instead of just writing about Anne Frank, I wrote about, you know, this sort of like ridiculousness of the way these, you know, the use of that people make of dead Jews to basically tell stories that make them feel better about themselves. And the first line in that piece was, people love dead Jews, living Jews, not so much. And that piece came out in, I wrote it in the summer of 2018, and it came out in one of their fall issues. It came out about 3 days before the massacre at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. Within like hours of that that massacre, the New York Times called me and was like, you know, we'd like you to write an op-ed about dead Jews, you know. And then it's like, I became, as I put it in the book, I became like the New York Times's go-to person for like the emerging literary genre of school shooting op-eds. It's like, you know, I didn't apply for this job. But, you know, I sort of like just sort of noticing, like, you know, everywhere, like I would be writing for like, you know, mainstream publications, like the editors, like that's what they wanted me to write about was dead Jews. And I just sort of thought like, why is this happening? You know, and I spent 20 years not writing this book. You know, I spent 20 years, like I used to, you know, so as you heard, I've written 5 novels. They're all about, you know, aspects of Jewish culture and Jewish history. I have a PhD in Yiddish and Hebrew. And, you know, when I used to talk about my other books, I often in public events would ask the audience, you know, how many people here can name 4 concentration camps? And then I would ask the follow-up question, how many of those same people can name 4 Yiddish writers, right? Like 80% of the people murdered in the Holocaust were Yiddish speakers. It's a famously Yiddish, famously literary culture. And, you know, I'm like, why do we care so much about how these people died when we don't care at all about how these people lived? And I think at that time, like now I think, look back at that and think I was kind of naive, because I think I did not appreciate sort of like this behemoth role that dead Jews play in the world's imagination. So, you know, I kind of wrote this book in a sense like a, you know, against my will, in a way. You know, there's this point where like you get to this point where you see something and you can't unsee it. And, you know, it's sort of, you know, you don't have a choice in a sense as a writer.
Do you think that it's mainly non-Jews who have this interest in dead Jews, or is it also American Jews themselves who are sort of more interested in, more knowledgeable about the Holocaust than other aspects of Judaism?
I mean, I think there's probably an education problem in that, like, yes, there are probably a lot of American Jews who are not particularly educated in, you know, Jewish tradition or culture, you know, culture or literature, et cetera. And those people, like they're getting the sort of maybe the same exposure to, you know, Holocaust education that, you know, is the organized Jewish community is kind of presented to a wider public. So that's what they have access to. That said, I think that there's sort of something else. There is like a way that, I mean, Judaism is like a very memory centric culture. I mean, I would argue that all cultures are in one way or another, but you know, this is sort of very explicit in Judaism, right? There's this idea of like time being almost like a spiral rather than a where there's sort of like this double helix of loss and renewal. There's this idea that you're always sort of reliving these events from the past. And so I think that that does play into a lot of the way that American Jews think about past, you know, think about history and the present. But like, I think that there's something different though going on with like a broader public with these, with Holocaust. And it's not just about Holocaust memorialization, because that's, I mean, there are some essays in the book about that, but like, it's sort of like a much broader topic. So I think that, the problem is that like, there was a point about, 25 or 30 years ago where, the Jewish community in the United States was like building all these Holocaust museums. This was when Holocaust survivors were aging. And there was this idea, like, you have to sort of, institutionalize this memory. And, the idea was there was something kind of hopeful about that project, right? Because the idea behind it was, first of all, combating Holocaust denial, but also the idea was sort of something like, people are going to come to these museums and then they'll sort of see what the world did to the Jews and where hatred can lead. And they will then, stop hating Jews. But, 25 years later, I think we can maybe reevaluate whether or not this was effective. And, I'm personally not convinced that it was. So that's like a broader question. I don't know if that really answers your question about, what you were saying about, I think that there is like a cultural education situation with a lot of American Jews who maybe are not so connected to the community, don't have much of a Jewish education themselves, and are sort of, entering this world the same way that a broader non-Jewish public is entering it.
I'll just say for the audience that we have a Q&A tab at the bottom. At the end of the conversation, we'll leave 15, 20 minutes to answer, for Dara to answer questions. So if as we're talking, anything comes up that you would like to ask, go ahead and enter it in that tab and I can read the questions at the end. It makes me think that for in earlier centuries, the sort of official Christian theological view of Jews was, we want them to stay around suffering so that it'll be sort of evidence that Jews are wrong and we're right. Like, there's a place for Jews in the world. The place for the Jews is to be martyrs, basically. And I wonder if you think that there's any sort of deep background of this attitude that you're talking about. I mean, is it something like that's the role that Jews play in the larger world, not just recently, but going back to ancient times, is to be people who suffer, people who are victims?
I don't know enough about Christian theology to speak with authority on this subject. I'm not going to pretend that I know enough about that. But I do think that there is, as you would put it, like a deep background there, in that there's a lot of, there is this kind of martyrology that's going on in the way that, there's this story about dead Jews is presented. And it is like, and I talked about this in my essay about Anne Frank, where I talk about how, there's this idea that, the most famous line from her diary is this line, I still believe, despite, in spite of everything, that people are truly good at heart. And, this is the line that's like plastered on book jackets and it's on the walls of the museum. And, I do think there's like, a little bit of this, like, as you put it, like, maybe the legacy of, Christianity in Western, in Western civilization, that's in this idea that like, this is like, a murdered Jew is offering us grace, an absolution from our sins or something like that. I don't know enough about Christian theology to say this, but I do think like there is a parallel there where, because what I think is amazing about the way that that line is used is, and as I put it in the book, we talk about it as though it's like, this inspires us, by which we mean it flatters us, right? Because it makes us feel absolved the flaws in our civilization that lead to piles of murdered girls, because like if this like dead Jewish girl offered us grace, then like, we must be absolved. It must be true. In order to get to that point where that's what you think that means, you have to jump over something like super obvious, which is, Anne Frank wrote that line about people being truly good at heart 3 weeks before she met people who weren't. Right? I mean, she wrote that line, 3 weeks later, she's arrested and deported to Auschwitz. She met people there who were not good at heart, right? I mean, and that's sort of like, you have to just jump right over that reality in order to get to this like inspirational message. And it's, that's the sort of like, when you talk, and there's a book, here I am promoting someone else's book. It's like a very academic book, actually. David Nirenberg, a historian at University of Chicago, wrote a book a number of years ago called Anti-Judaism. And he sort of talks about like the role that this idea of being anti-Judaism plays in like various aspects of the history of the West. And he talks about Christianity, he talks about Islam, but he also talks about the ancient world, he talks about the Enlightenment. So yeah, there are people who know a lot more about this than I do, but you know, I'm a storyteller and I'm sort of like reflecting on what I'm seeing in the contemporary setting.
Well, one reason I thought of this was because you have a great essay in the book about the idea of stories having a happy ending. And you argue that maybe the idea that a story has to have a happy ending or a redemptive ending is not a Jewish idea. Tell us about that. What makes that not something you find in Jewish literature?
Sure. So yes, and that is a place where I do talk about this a little more explicitly. There's an essay in the book called Fictional Dead Jews that's about sort of, it opens with this idea that, so I'm a novelist and I get a lot of mail from readers. Some of it's nicer than others. And I once had a reader who wrote to me about, you know, a book, you know, something of, you know, she's like, I was reading your novel, The World to Come, which is a novel about a pogrom survivor. And she's like, I got to the scene with the horse being beaten, so I threw the book against the wall. You know, I think it's more important for writers to write books for people to laugh and enjoy and feel uplifted. And that would be more of a service to mankind. And, you know, I wrote a letter to this, you know, to this reader, which I was smart enough not to send, where I was like, you know, dear Denise, sorry about the horse. It was a reference to Crime and Punishment, another book you might want to avoid, right? Like, you know, since when do we need literature to be this uplifting thing? So, but it's not that we need the literature to be like a happy ending. I do think, and I see this, like from, even from my own readers of my own books, that there is this like idea in for English speaking readers and, you know, probably other readers too, of this, like they need this narrative arc. And so where I go with it in my book, In People Have Dead Jews, is to a mid-century literary critic named Frank Kermode. I think in the book I say he's American and that's a mistake, he's British. But Frank Kermode, he's you know, writing in the 1950s, 1960s, he has a book called The Sense of an Ending. And he's talking about plot structure in Western literature. And he says that plot structure in Western literature is related to the history of Western religion. Right, because he says that we read literature because we're looking for consonance in the world, that what he calls consonance is like the idea that like we live in a coherent world where things like make sense and have a purpose, you know, and he gives this example of like, you know, the purpose of literature is like to, you know, impose this meaning on the world in the same way that, you know, traditional religion or religious texts would do that. And he gives this example where he says, you know, the Bible is a familiar mode of this narrative arc. You know, it starts at the beginning, within the beginning, and it ends with the vision of the end, with the words, even so, come Lord Jesus. And I'm reading this in graduate school, and first of all, I'm like, that's not how I thought the Bible ended. But also, like, you know, sort of realizing, like, you know, there isn't in Judaism this expectation of consonance, right? Like, there isn't this idea, this larger theological idea of, like, you know, that there's going to be like everything wrapped up in a bow, right? I mean, there might be like this aspiration to a redemptive, a messianic age in the future, but there's no idea that that's here already or imminent. So, you know, and I do think that that affects it. So what I noticed is that when I was reading all these in my graduate work, and this is what I talk about in the book, I was reading work in, when I say Jewish literature, what I mean in this context is literature in Jewish languages. So, and I was looking specifically at Hebrew and Yiddish literature. And what I noticed was like the writers I was reading in those literary traditions, like they never do any of those things that we expect books to do. Like if you think about what we expect as English language readers, like, you know, we want the good guys to be saved, right? If that doesn't happen, we at least want the main character to, you know, have an epiphany or have a moment of grace, right? I mean, these are all very Christian terms. None of that happens in like canonical Hebrew and Yiddish literature. Like it's more like what happens is these characters go through all these events, some of which are kind of horrible. And then it's like the idea is not for there to be this big resolution at the end. The idea is like to sort of see the character go through this kind of masterclass in resilience, right? And that's much more of the model, is this idea of resilience and endurance. And it's just a very different idea of like what literature is for and what stories are for. And there's, you know, the way I put it in the book is, you know, there's this idea among these Jewish language artists that, you know, you can't sort of pretend that the world makes sense. And, you know, you can't be true to the human experience while pretending to make sense of the world.
Yeah. When I saw the book and the title, it made me think of the, I think it's your most recent novel called Eternal Life,
Yes.
Which is, it's sort of like a response to this book in advance. Yes. That novel is about a story about an ancient Jewish woman who literally can't die. And at the end of each of her lives, she comes back and is reborn. Do you think that that's sort of like a response? Were you thinking, this is what Jewish literature really is? It's about endurance. It's about survival. It's not about dead Jews, but living Jews.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I mean it literal in that book, right? It's literally about, like, you know, a woman who can't die. I mean, it's like Mel Brooks's 2,000-year-old man, but this is like the 2,000-year-old mom,
right?
You know, whose life is less fun than the 2,000-year-old man. But yeah, so I mean, it and you know, obviously, this is a very, you know, it's not very subtle. This is like this metaphor for this sort of endurance in Jewish history. Yeah, so it is. I mean, look, like I said, I spent 20 years not writing this book.
Right.
You know, this is like a book I didn't want to write. And first of all, because it's focused on life versus death, but also because, it was always very important to me to define Jewish identity in my work. I mean, in my life too, but also in my work from the inside, right? Like where, you know, in all of my novels, like, you know, I have characters who are, you know, some are engaging with this tradition, sometimes struggling with it, sometimes rejecting it, but like always sort of defining those things on their own terms, right? It's not about like people whose lives are shaped by these external forces beyond their control.
Yeah.
You know, I give my characters this agency, right? And that's what, like, the story People Love Dead Jews is sort of the, you know, the sort of like a funhouse mirror of that, right? Which is like this idea that like Jews are these figures in history that don't have agency. And that's sort of what I'm, you know, pushing back against. And then in this book, really throwing it in your face.
Yeah. And you have a couple of essays in the book that are tell these weird and sort of amazing stories of places where you wouldn't have thought there were any Jews, building monuments to the Jews that no longer live there, including Harbin, China, and then also one in Syria where they have sort of digitized this synagogue and put it online, even though there are no Jews there anymore. Why do you think there are places, and this, you see this a lot in Eastern Europe too, where people are happy to talk about the Jews that used to live there once they got rid of them?
Yeah, so like the way I put it in the book is, you know, there's this tourist industry concept, Jewish heritage sites. And that term is like this brilliant piece of marketing, right? Because it sounds so much better than property seized or from, you know, dead or expelled Jews. Like, who wants to go to that, right? Like, this is like, you know, Jewish heritage sites. It sounds so benign, right? So, I mean, you know, So again, going back to that idea of like, you know, there's emotional work that this is doing for people. Yeah, I mean, in a lot of these places, you know, the local people were, you know, didn't really mind when the Jews there were, you know, murdered or driven out. But now, you know, they pine for the dead Jews. And also in some cases, like the thing about the Chinese example is, you know, so just to explain for listeners, there's, this is a city called Harbin in northeastern China. And the weird thing about the city was it was actually built by Jews. So it was, the Russians had gotten permission from China to build a branch of the Trans-Siberian Railroad. They needed like a junction for this railroad. They basically needed to build a town. And they needed like Russian-speaking entrepreneurs to build this town for them. So they're like, hey, Jews, how would you like to live without anti-Semitic restrictions, without being a bottom feeder in a New York City sweatshop? Great news, you can move to Manchuria. And that was what happened. So this like 20,000 Russian Jews built this town in Manchuria in the early 20th century. Various regimes eventually made their lives so unbelievably difficult that, you know, the last Jewish family was evacuated by Israel in 1962. Today there's one Jew in Harbin who's basically employed by the government to like run these Jewish heritage sites. But the thing about Harbin, and this is like, you know, so you mentioned like these places in Eastern Europe, the thing about Harbin is that as I think, you know, they said the quiet part out loud, because in Harbin, the local government has invested $30 million in restoring these Jewish heritage sites. And in all these like public conferences and events and forums and things that they arranged to publicize this, they very openly say, you know, Jews are rich and we would like some of their money. And if we invest our money into building these Jewish heritage sites, then Jews will come to Harbin both as tourists and as investors and give us their money. Dun, dun. Like they literally say this like openly. And then it's like, you go there and, you know, you go to this Jewish museum and there's like life-size plaster people like posed in front of typewriters and pianos. And the captions are like real Jew in Harbin. And, you know, like you walk down the street where they have like these historic houses and like, there'll be a plaque on the side of like the wall of a house that says like, you know, this house was built by a Jew. Like, it's just like, it's like this like amazingly exaggerated version of what you do, as you say, see in many places in the world. I mean, and this is sort of what's so amazing is like, one thing I talk about in the book is there's this medieval Jewish traveler named Benjamin of Tudela, who was a Spanish Jewish merchant in the 12th century. And he wrote this travelogue. He traveled around the world, which, you know, was basically around the Mediterranean and maybe part of the Middle East. And, you know, he kept this travelogue where he talks about visiting all these like thriving Jewish communities in Yemen and in Baghdad and in, he claims he went to China, although I don't think he did. And what's amazing is like, now you go on that trip around the world and instead of visiting like living, thriving Jewish communities, you're visiting their graves. And it's just like this, like, you know, uncomfortable doesn't begin to describe it. And, you know, you sort of like realize like, are they building this for me, the Jewish tourist? I mean, other than just in a cynical way, like they want me to come and spend money here? Or is like, is it doing something for them? You know, and it's just like, you know, I'm not claiming that like these, you know, people shouldn't restore these Jewish heritage sites, but like, you know, there's something going on here that's, you know, there's better and worse ways to do this, I guess is the, you know, is the most generous way to put it. And there's a lot of ways to do it poorly.
Well, I was especially interested in your essay about that traveling Auschwitz exhibit that came through New York a couple of years ago, which I also saw. And you write about how even when the story is told well and scrupulously, it still leaves you with a bad feeling. What was your reaction to that exhibit? Maybe some of our listeners saw it as well.
Yeah, so this was a show that was, it had been in Madrid and then it was in New York in 2019. And I think it stayed open for, I think it even was, you know, during the pandemic, I think it may have still been open for part of the pandemic as well. This show got enormous news coverage. It was on NBC. It was like, there were segments on TV. There was like, it was reviewed everywhere. It was a huge exhibit. Like they had 700 artifacts that they had brought from the Auschwitz Site Museum in Poland. And, you know, the Museum of Jewish Heritage, which was hosting it, like had to like change their floor plan to accommodate this exhibit. What I thought was amazing about that is like, in all of this, like no one really discussed that, you know, most of these Holocaust museums are, they always tended to be funded by like Jewish philanthropists or nonprofit groups. This exhibit was made by a company called Musalia, which is a for-profit European company whose business is blockbuster museum shows. And their most famous show that they had done before this was, any of you who have like lived in a major city about 15 years ago will probably recognize this. It was the Bodies Exhibition. This was like the show. Yeah, you know, this was like the show where they had like cadavers that were like, you know, injected with dyes and posed in, you know, various ways. And it was, you know, quite a controversial show. I'm like, you know, who thought this was a good idea to like have these people do this Auschwitz show? Oh, they also made a show about the Titanic. As I put it in my book, I'm like, you know, this of course is not a disaster porn company. It's an education company. Who's going to argue against education? I mean, okay, right. Well, I mean, there maybe is an argument to be made against education. So, I mean, and as I said in the book though, you know, I mean, as you said, it's done. They do everything right. Right. I mean, it was all done by these like world-class historians, it's very comprehensive, all those things. But I was like, I went to this, I'm like, they did everything right. And I never want to go to one of these shows ever again. And the reason was because, you know, you get to the end of that show and there's like Holocaust survivors talking on a loop about how people need to love each other. And I'm like, you know, what's interesting is like, I have a PhD in Yiddish. I've read a fair amount of like Holocaust survivor literature in Yiddish. I can't remember ever reading anything in Yiddish by a Holocaust survivor that suggests this idea. Like they don't talk about love, you know, like they talk about their destroyed centuries old communities, right? Yeah. You know, they talk about Jewish national independence, right? You know, they talk about this like destroyed culture, right? Like, you know, like the Holocaust didn't happen because of a lack of love. It happened because entire societies abdicated responsibility for their problems, right? I mean, that's why it happened. You know, it's like, it's not a mystery why this happened. Like people will do anything to blame their problems on somebody else.
Yeah.
Right. And it's like, you know, but they were turning this into like this like bumper sticker of like, you know, it was like, you know, the most anodyne, pointless thing. And it was sort of like, Auschwitz just became this like metaphor for like how low humanity can sink, right? And then it was sort of like, you know, and I'm sitting in that exhibit and at some point I'm like, you know, why do I need to know this in such granular detail, right? Why does anybody need to know this in such granular detail? But then also like, you know, maybe by presenting this as like, look how bad things can get, like we're in a sense like giving people ideas about our standards because like, you know, yes, we should all learn about the Holocaust so we don't repeat it. But it's like, that has kind of come to mean that like anything that's, you know, anything short of the Holocaust is like not the Holocaust.
Right,
like the bar is kind of high.
Yeah.
You know, and then you're like, oh, you know, somebody walked into a shul and blew away a bunch of Jews. Like, well, you know, it's not the Holocaust. Like, you know, yeah. It's not systemic. It's a lone wolf. Like, it's just sort of like, you know, you get this like crazy idea that like anything short of the Holocaust is like fine.
Yeah.
And it was just like, so it was, you know, and in seeing that, I saw that like there was just this effort to turn this into this metaphor to teach you like this nice lesson about humanity and redemption. Very similar to what was going on with the Anne Frank example. It's like, you know, this is a message about the children of the world. And yeah. In the process, there's this erasure of Jewish identity, right? And the message with all these museums is kind of like, these people who were murdered, they were just like us. You know, it's like, that's why we should care about these people, because, you know, they were just like you and me. They're just like us. Well, I mean, the problem is that like, Jews have spent 3,000 years like, not being just like everybody else, right? And that's sort of like the amazing story of Jewish history, is like how you have this like counterculture that sort of winds its way through Western, you know, Western history, you know, and that's just like completely, it's this erasure that I see, and I see it in so many contexts that are like far beyond, you know, Holocaust memorialization.
Yeah. Well, one of the questions in the Q&A is about Holocaust novels, why you think they're so popular. And also in the book, you talk about people read Anne Frank, but what are they not reading? So I wonder if you could tell people, if they want to read books that are not like this, what are some of the more authentic and interesting books about Jewish experience that you should be reading, that in Yiddish or in Hebrew or in English?
Sure. So to answer the first question, which is like, you know, why are Holocaust novels so popular? I mean, there's something easy about it, right? And I will tell you this, like, as a novelist, like, you know, if you like set your book during the Holocaust, like you don't have to set up like a moral world. Like it's all there for you. Like, you know, it's like, it doesn't take any courage to say that the Holocaust was bad. I mean, maybe if you live in Iran, but like, you know, there's not like, you know, this is like all set up for you. And it's like, and then you end up with these characters that don't have any agency, right? And it's like, you can just use this. I mean, and that's what I see happening in all these like popular Holocaust novels. It's just like uses this backdrop. It's like kind of, and it's it really is obscene because it's done in this way that like erases Jewish life, right? I mean, and that's one of the things that I see in like, you know, the way that these, you know, figures are used, like someone like Anne Frank, who like was living in a Western European country, speaking a Western European language, you know, like she wasn't particularly religious. Like, well, you know, a lot of the children who were murdered in the Holocaust were Hasidic. They don't care about them, right? Yeah. So to answer the question, something else that you could read. So I talk about this in the book. I give an example of like, here's a Holocaust novel. If you really want to read a Holocaust novel, the book, The Tree of Life by Chava Rosenfarb, a Yiddish poet she mostly writes poetry, but this is a novel. This is a monumental work that's about the ghetto in Lodz in Poland. And it's a it's enormous. It's like a 3-volume work. You know, it's probably about 1,000 pages total. But like, what's amazing about that book is that she just unfolds this panorama of Jewish life in Lodz. And it's like, you know, it's one of these books that's like, it's not just like, you know, reading a book. It feels more like living a life, or more like maybe 10 lives, because she's got like 10 main characters who are from like all different walks of life. You know, she's got like religious people and secular people and socialists and communists and Zionists and, you know, and poets and writers and artists and industrialists and, you know, and also like, you know, these people are like, you know, they're adults, right? They're all adults, like even the ones who are maybe 18 or 19, but like everyone is like making their own choices about their lives. The whole first volume is set before the ghetto is formed. So you meet all these people before like sadists take over their lives. And then it's like, they're the same people in volume 2 that they are in volume 1. They're just like, you know, starving, but they're the same people, right? And like, you know, the people who are jerks are still jerks, and the people who aren't jerks are, you know, it's like, you, and they're all the same people, but also like, you see like what was lost, right? Because it's like this vast Yiddish speaking world that contains all of these different people. Like, we don't have that in a Jewish language, except in Israel now, where you have this like wide variety of Jews from different backgrounds who are all communicating the same language. And when I just, and it's not just about, oh, we speak the same language. It's also like, you know, we know the same sources. We know the same, we have the same references, right? And even though they like are butting heads about, I mean, you know, politically and religiously and in every possible way. So that's just like, and it's just, it's a fantastic book. I mean, she's masterful. So
that's was that based on her own experience? Was she a survivor?
Yes. So yeah, so she did survive the Lodz ghetto, but like what I think is, and you know, so like one of these 10 characters is like maybe the closest to who she is. Like there's this, an aspiring teenage poet who is most similar to her, but like, that's like one of many characters and like hardly the most important character, right? I mean, it's like, that's what I think. It's like, it's really, it's not a work of testimony. It's a work of imagination, right? Because she takes you into all these different people's lives. And you know, that's what I think is really amazing. And like, she's not, I mean, the other thing is that like, you're reading this book and you realize like, nobody in this book knows what you know. Like these people get put in the ghetto and they're like, wow, this sucks. Like I just got noticed for deportation. Maybe I'll go, it can't be worse than here. Yeah. Right. And like, and she's writing that like not in an ironic way, like just this is the way these people are living, right? You know, and it's like, you know, there's not, you know, there isn't this like knowledge of like what's happening. Like you just see this like confusion closing in on people and you see how people are reacting to this confusion. Like it's not a morality play. Yeah. Right. Like these like popular novels about the Holocaust now are like it's like cheeseball morality play where like you're using it, as I said, to feel good about yourself. You're not gonna feel good about yourself reading this book.
Yeah.
Yeah, characters you care about, they're gonna die, right? Like, there's no inspirational message in this book, and that's like, but it's a masterpiece. So that's one example. I feel like there was another question that was in there.
So Denise will not like that book.
The one no, Denise would totally hate that book.
Another one question, which connects to this, is a question about Jewish literature in different languages. So you maybe you could tell us a little bit about what your background was like growing up and your sort of Jewish experience, but you are a scholar of Yiddish and Hebrew literature, but in your own writing, you write in English, which is not a Jewish language. So I wonder if you have any thoughts about what that means to write as a Jewish writer, not in a Jewish language.
Well, I mean, I have a lot of thoughts about that.
I thought you might.
Yes. Yes. So, I mean, I started writing these novels in a sense out of jealousy because I was reading these Yiddish and Hebrew writers. And so just to answer this sort of, you know, more maybe perfunctory question. So I grew up in suburban New Jersey, in fact, in the same town where I still live. I'm that boring. I went to public school. Like I never went to a Jewish school. Like I'm not Orthodox. Like, you know, I'm religious, but not Orthodox. Like, you know, I didn't like, it's not like, oh, I like went to yeshiva for 20 years with my Yiddish speaking grandma. And that's why I know these languages. No, they're acquired. I mean, my mother has a PhD in Jewish studies. So like, it's not, you know, it's not from nowhere. This is obviously super important in my family. And, you know, I was learning Hebrew in like everywhere but Jewish day school. So like, you know, afternoon Hebrew schools and adult education classes and summer programs and all those kind of things. And then I learned Yiddish in college. So because I was studying Hebrew literature and I got to this point where, you know, I was reading writers who were writing in both languages and I wanted to be able to read the rest of their stuff. So that was where so that's the brief answer. But I was reading these Yiddish and Hebrew writers. This happened in college and I just was so jealous of them. Was not jealous of their lives, which mostly were horrible, but like was jealous of their language because, you know, they were able to engage with these traditional Jewish texts in like all kinds of like fun and interesting and ironic ways. Because they knew that their readers would like get all these references and they could just play with the language. And I started thinking at that point, like, you know, every language has like an archaeology of belief that's underneath it that make maybe native speakers don't even hear, right? Like when, you know, you say to somebody in English, you know, oh, this will be happen for better or for worse. You're not thinking like, oh, that's from the Anglican marriage ceremony. But like, of course, right? I mean, it's like, you know, these beliefs come to the surface like every time somebody sneezes. So in Jewish languages, those kinds of references are to the Torah and the Tanakh and the Talmud and the, you know, and the liturgy and the Siddur and all these like traditional Jewish texts. And I just was so jealous. I was like, look what these authors can do. They can just like play with all these sources and incorporate these stories. And I was like, wouldn't it be cool if we had that in English? You know, and what I mean, and so then I embarked on writing these novels to write in English as though English were a Jewish language. And what I mean by that is not that I wanted to like write books with a lot of words in italics, but like writing books where like the structures of the stories, the structures of the plot, And then a lot of those kinds of like references and allusions are drawn from Jewish texts, but like in a way that's accessible to any English language reader. So, you know, like I have a novel called A Guide for the Perplexed. You know, many Jewish readers will immediately recognize that title as being, you know, this work by Moses Maimonides from the 12th century. It's this, you know, classic work of Jewish philosophy. A lot of readers will be like my taxi driver at one of my book events at that point when I was touring for that book, where he's like, oh, what's your book called? I'll Guide for the Perplexed. That sounds like an amazing self-help book that I would totally read. Right? I'm like, well, you'll be disappointed. But, you know, even a reader like that is in the course of reading that book, they're going to find out what Guide for the Perplexed is. Like, it's part of the plot. Right. Maimonides, the character in that book. I'm weaving all those things in, and I'm trying to bring that access to those texts into, you know, a novel that, like, you know, you can read on the beach and enjoy, and, you know, different people are reading it in different ways, and that's fine with me.
Yeah. Looking at the questions here, one listener is asking, you discuss your thesis in relationship to history and literature. Are you aware of any examples of this in other genres, specifically film? I think films about the Holocaust and films about Jews are one of the main ways that people sort of encounter these ideas, and films about the Holocaust are especially egregious, I think, right? I mean, do you think that this idea of loving dead Jews, a lot of people come to that through movies?
Okay, so I actually just last week, I have a podcast episode. So my podcast that you heard the trailer for before, Adventures with Dead Jews, episode 3 is about Schindler's List, right? Which was like sort of like, you know, the first like these like, you know, seminal non-documentary films about the Holocaust. It was made by Steven Spielberg. Steven Spielberg made that movie at the same time that he was making the movie Jurassic Park. Like, he was shooting his like, you know, he built a whole concentration camp in Poland, and he's shooting all day in this concentration camp. And then he would like go back home to his rented house in Krakow and get on the phone with his colleagues in California and be like editing Velociraptor footage all night. And so what I did was I watched those movies together. Mm. And I was kind of like alarmed by how similar they are in a lot of ways. And, you know, I was sort of like, you know, so in that episode, I rewatched Schindler's List. I talk about like what it felt like to see it, you know, as a teenager when I saw it, when it came out in 1993. And I also, you know, I talked to filmmakers and historians and, you know, other people who have a little more insight than I do. But yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, the problem is that like in the same way that we have this narrative arc we expect in fiction, like, you know, there's a whole, I mean, that narrative arc is even stricter, you know, particularly in like Hollywood films, right? I mean, there's very narrow things that they can do in Hollywood films in terms of like what you're allowed to do for your audience. And like, you know, a movie like Schindler's List is like what critics now would call like a white savior narrative. You know, it's like, you know, minority people are being exploited and then like a white person comes in and saves the day. And like what I found was like kind of astonishing watching that movie again was, as I put it in the podcast, like there like aren't really any Jewish characters in Schindler's List, right? Like, you know, even like Ben Kingsley, like he has very few lines in that movie, you know, and it's really just this like arena for these two men, like Schindler and this like Nazi henchman who are like going at it. And then like the Jews are just like kind of background, right? It's like this kind of backdrop. So absolutely very similar to what you see in a lot of Holocaust fiction, right, where it's just like used as this kind of backdrop for this other story, you know, and that was what I found so disturbing, right? I mean, that was, yeah. I mean, I doubt that Spielberg would make that movie the same way today. I think he was, you know, had his own reasons for doing it that way at the time.
So another question is, do you write in the book about Jesus? And I don't think you do, but the title of one of the essays is that Anne Frank is everybody's second favorite dead Jew. And I was assuming that the first was Jesus. That's who you have.
Yes, but that's as far as it goes, right? I mean, I don't really probe into that now.
But it sort of raises the question of when you are writing for American readers, many of them I imagine not Jewish, and when you're out on tours and speaking to people, do you encounter people who are religious Christians who are sort of interested in your work because they're interested in Judaism for religious reasons?
Oh, sure. I mean, like, you know, those, I mean, it's funny, I just spoke before about how I was trying to sort of make English into a Jewish language and refer to all these ancient Jewish texts. I mean, like, religious Christian readers love my books because, like, you know, those readers really know the Bible. I mean, a lot of times the Jewish readers maybe don't know the Bible as well as some of the Christian readers do. Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, but the other thing that I noticed, though, is that, you know, you write one book as a writer. And then, you know, when you publish that book, like everyone's reading a different book than the book you wrote, which is like not necessarily, it's actually not a bad thing because lots of times they're reading a better book than the book you wrote. You know, so a lot of my books, like, yes, I absolutely have a lot of religious Christian readers. You know, I've spoken at churches. I've been on, you know, I've spoken at like, faith in writing kind of conferences and, you know, yeah, absolutely. There are people who see my work as like, not necessarily as like, I'm a Jewish writer, but like, I'm a writer who writes about spirituality, right? So, I mean, yeah, absolutely. And I, you know, and that's something that like, I think is like kind of a gift of publishing books is that, you know, you find a lot of readers that you might not have found otherwise. But, you know, with this book in particular though, I sort of am very, I want this book to reach a wider audience because, you know, in a sense, like, you know, the things that I'm talking about in this book are more important for a non-Jewish public to know about in a sense than it is for Jewish readers to know about. One thing that I've noticed is, you know, we started the conversation about the title, which is what I noticed is that like the title gets a very different reaction from Jewish and non-Jewish readers is one thing that I've noticed, even just among people I know. Like when I mentioned this title to non-Jewish friends of mine, they're all like, ooh, that's very provocative, right? And whereas like my Jewish friends are like, that's hilarious,
yeah,
right? But I think maybe non-Jewish readers, like they don't feel like they have, you know, like they don't feel like they have the authority to like understand that this is funny or something like that. Like maybe they feel a little bit more like they, you know, there's things that maybe they feel like they're not allowed to say or something like that. So, but I mean, I think it's like, it's, you know, one of the people who wrote the book actually is Jim Carroll, who's, you know, he's a historian who he wrote Constantine's Sword. He writes a lot about Catholic history. And I mean, he's like, and what he says in his word is he's like, you know, Christian readers need this book.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
So maybe as we draw to an end here, a reader, a listener asks about post-war philo-Semitism. And I think that one way to read your book is that it's about the end of an era of post-war philo-Semitism. I mean, after the Holocaust, there was maybe a half century where anti-Semitism was taboo and people didn't want to be associated with it. I wonder if you think that that is changing, if it's changing in your and my adult lifetimes, and in particular in the last couple of years, do you feel like anti-Semitism is more of a serious issue that you think about, that you see other Jews thinking about, that you write about?
I mean, I don't even think it's up for debate, right? I mean, I know that like, you know, Adam and I are about the same age. I know like I'm gonna go out on a limb and guess that like, you know, anti-Semitism was not part of your life growing up. It certainly wasn't part of mine. I'm 44, you know, and I feel that, you know, yeah, I do think that there was sort of this, like, as you put it, this era where this was like, you know, a taboo, but like, it is part of my children's lives, you know, not in necessarily a way that like, you know, they're encountering a lot of like interpersonal hatred or exclusion, but in a way that like, you know, my daughter can't go on Instagram without seeing this stuff. Like it's just there. Like I didn't, you know, I wasn't encountering anything like this when I was a teenager. You know, so I think, and that's absolutely, you know, and like my daughter's encountering all this on Instagram and like doesn't even mention it to me because it's just like, isn't that normal? Like that's just normal, like whatever. Right. And so, I mean, that's sort of, that's very shocking and jarring to me. And, you know, and there's like, you know, there's like endless, you know, in a lot of ways, self-serving debates in the Jewish community about like, why is this like re-emerging or whatever, you know, and depending where you are on the political spectrum, you always blame people on the other end of the political spectrum for it. But I think the reality is, as the listener says, like, you know, there was this taboo after the Holocaust where like, you know, that made it like so grotesque that it was socially unacceptable to be anti-Semitic. And the reality is just like the most convincing answer for why this is re-emerging is just that like, it's the most boring answer, which is that like people who remember that are kind of dying off. And now it's like, you know, that like basically hating Jews is normal and now normal is returning. Super depressing. I mean, I hope I'm wrong about that. But I will add one other thing about it, which is that, you know, at the end of the book, I have an essay where I talk about the attacks. Mostly, I mean, I was writing it right before the pandemic. So really the attacks like toward right before the pandemic on the Hasidic community. And, you know, and I will tell you that like, first of all, you know, people, you know, the American Jewish community is all like, oh, why is there all of this anti-Semitism is reemerging? I think a lot of Hasidim will tell you it never went away. You know, it's just about how visible you are.
Yeah.
You know, so that's something. But also what I find shocking is like, you know, I was toward the end of the book, I write about these attacks on the Hasidic community. And I write about how I was looking through news reports about, you know, there was a shooting in Jersey City that was like an attack on a Hasidic owned grocery store. There was this like stabbings in Muncie, which is like this, you know, largely Hasidic town in upstate New York. You know, I was looking at news reports about those attacks, and it was astonishing because I almost couldn't find a news article about those attacks that didn't say something derogatory about the community being attacked in the article. Yeah. Like, it's amazing. Like, you know, you read these articles and they're like, well, you know, just for context, you know, there was a zoning battle between these Hasidic residents and non-Hasidic residents, you know, oh, there were all these tensions about the school board. And I'm like, do we normally settle municipal disputes with a machete? Because, you know, silly me, I didn't think so. Like, these articles are signaling something.
Yeah.
Right. They're sending a message about like, what's okay.
Yeah.
Right. And I think it really does happen. You know, and the truth is, like, you know, these attacks on the Hasidic community, like, they weren't happening because people, you know, disagree with Hasidic practice and belief. Like, they're happening because these people are visible.
Yeah. Well, it's a sobering book, and the title is funny in the way that Jewish humor often is, that it's sort of like you laugh to keep from crying. But it's a wonderful book. I really enjoyed reading it. And I hope everyone who's listening will get the chance to read it as well. So thank you, Dara. Thank you for everyone who joined us tonight. And thank you to Philadelphia Free Library for hosting us.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. And it's a pleasure to be here. And I just want to add, you know, as you say, the book is very sobering. If you're looking for a more fun version of this, the Adventures with Dead Jews podcast is like similar stories, but they are funnier. So if that helps you to find a way in, that would be that if you're looking, if you're like Denise and you're looking for something uplifting, you won't find it in my podcast, but at least you'll also laugh at the same time. So that's one other place you might want to look.
Sounds good. All right. Good night, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Adam.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.